Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We welcome all of you to call in or just listen in as our guest shares valuable information through her knowledges, experiences, and expertise in areas of need and resolutions to criminal justice reform, amongst many other things. Today, we want to welcome our guest, Nina Champion, and we are honored to have her on, who is a freelance consultant from London. She has worked 25 years across different aspects of the criminal justice system. She started her career as a criminal defense lawyer, then worked for the NGOs setting up pilot prevention and rehabilitation projects in prisons and in the communities. Nina has a master's degree in policy and politics, and is passionate about influencing systematic change through innovation, collaboration, and mobilizing networks of people with lived, learned, and professional expertise. So without further ado, I would like to welcome with us Nina Champion. And Nina, can you, once again, I've already pretty much introduced you, but can you let the audience know a little bit more about yourself before we start?
Yeah, thank you so much, Leona, for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be here. So I've worked in the UK. I'm based in London, and I've worked in the criminal justice sector for about 25 years. My first sort of experience working in the criminal justice sector was actually when I was 17. I used to live near to two prisons, a male prison and a female prison near to where I lived. And I used to sort of see that sign as I, you know, went to school, went about, and, you know, for saying Her Majesty's Prisons, and wondered what was up the end of that driveway. And I ended up doing some volunteering work. I used to spend my Sundays in the prison visit centre with families that were visiting their loved ones in prison, and then going across the visits hall working with the families and the men that were in the prison. And that was really my sort of first step into working in the criminal justice space and realizing that our system was really broken and that it was causing a lot of harm. And particularly I used to work with a lot of the children there who didn't know where they were necessarily or were very confused by the things that they'd done they couldn't give to their dad. But I also used to work inside with the men who were doing their industrial cleaning qualifications and seeing how much you know, getting education and coming up with business plans could give them hope for the future. So from there, I went on and I did a law degree and I became a criminal defence lawyer, as you've mentioned. So I was working in police stations at all times of day and night, being called out to see clients and then also in the court the next day, working with people who had been accused of different offences, representing them. And going to visit them in prisons and getting their instructions. But I really decided after sort of 2 years of working as a lawyer, again, that the system that I thought, you know, was supposed to rehabilitate, was supposed to address the causes why why people were committing offences, just wasn't working. And I was spending a lot of my spare time referring people to housing projects or referring them to drugs programs or, other support that they needed. Because there was just no one else doing that role. And so I decided to leave being a lawyer, as exciting as it was. We all know sort of the courtroom dramas and everything as exciting and and rewarding as the job was. I didn't feel like it was going to help more broadly to make our whole sort of system better. And I really then set off on a journey working for different NGOs, different charities, in the UK doing frontline work, trying to bring some innovation, trying to bring something different into the spaces I was working in. So, for example, I worked in a prison in London called Wormwood Scrubs Prison, a Victorian prison that we've got here. I was working on a program working with fathers that were in prison and their children on the outside, supporting them to prepare for release. I'd also set up a project working for a charity called Women in Prison that's based here in the UK, that does fantastic work, and I was looking at a housing project that supported mothers who were leaving prison, supporting them with accommodation and support for them and their children after release. And so I was doing this work, but actually then sort of realized that, you know, I could do lots of these small projects and maybe help, you know, 10 or 15 people at a time. But really, as you know, the system, you know, is, you know, was much bigger than that, and the problems were much bigger than that, and impacting, you know, sort of thousands of people. And so I then, as you sort of mentioned, I went and then studied a degree in policy and politics. And actually during that time, I worked in Parliament here in the UK. So I worked for two members of Parliament. So I could really start to understand how do we influence change with policymakers, with members of Parliament, with politicians, and get change, bigger systemic change. And then after that, I worked for another charity here in the UK called Prisoners Education Trust. And there I set up a big network of organisations working to improve the education provision in prison, and also after people were released from prison. And actually, as I was, sort of mentioned to you, I think about 6 years ago when I was working there, I went to the US. So I visited prisons across Europe and also in the United States, looking at the links between prisons and universities and the partnerships that they've got and supporting people from prison into higher education. And then for the last 5 years, I was the director of a charity called the Criminal Justice Alliance, which was a network of organizations, about 200 organizations and academics working right across the criminal justice system. Because as you'll have just heard, I've worked, you know, whether it's in sort of the police stations or courts or prisons or with people after release. I've also worked in prevention, so working with young people at risk of offending. So I've kind of got a view that's quite unique of the whole criminal justice system and all its different parts. And so the work I was doing at Criminal Justice Alliance and the work that I'm doing now is about trying to kind of look at the whole system, the complexity of our whole criminal justice system. Wow. And try to break down all those silos between the different bits of our system and how they impact each other.
I tell you, you have had quite a life, and you sound so much like Frans Dahl from Amsterdam, a former warden. He's involved in so many. He's involved with the United Nations, with the Ministry of Psychiatry. These are all global, and the International Red Cross, and he's just like all over the place, and it sounds to me like you've had a lot of experience. You mentioned that you've been in America. You've been in American prisons, or you've been in America?
I've been in American prisons. So I was lucky enough to receive a travel scholarship, a fellowship from something called the Churchill Trust here in the UK. And I went to California and was hosted by some wonderful people doing incredible work in California, who were doing link-ups between prisons and universities. And when I was over there, I taught a number of classes, and I was able to shadow the work that was going on, where universities and lecturers were going into prisons, teaching seminars, teaching, you know, running university courses, and also with people like Project Rebound, who were working with people who had been released from prison to support them to go to university after release. So I spent a lot of time on university campuses as well, meeting people who'd been incarcerated, who'd then been released from prison, were now studying for degrees, and, you know, things that they'd never imagined that was, you know, that they were going to be able to do, but were now, you know, studying in some of the, you know, institutions that you've got over there in the US. And I also met people who'd done that and then were now influencing systemic change, who are now, you know, changing laws, campaigning, community organizing, you know, regularly meeting with, you know, your politicians over there to get changes to law and legislation. And one of the things that I came across when I was there, all the fantastic people, I went to conference that was called Beyond the Bars, that was at UCLA when I was over there, which was incredible. And many of the people that I met when I was on my visit to California, who were influencing change at that sort of national, you know, or sort of state level, had been through a program called Just Leadership USA. And so it was a leadership training program over the course of 12 months that they'd been on. So I funded myself to go back to the US to New York the year later, because I wanted to go and visit the office that was in Harlem, for Just Leadership USA. And there was also another Beyond the Bars conference at Columbia University in New York. So I went over there and spent another week really just sort of meeting more people, finding out more about this program, because I recognized that we didn't have anything like this in the UK, and I wanted to learn from it and to be inspired by it and to bring it across to the UK.
I want to ask you, since you've been in American prisons, and I'm going to take this, hold on one second, 919, I'm going to take you off mute in a second. 919, do you want to state your name, please? Oh, maybe they're just listening, 919?
Yes, I'm here,
Hello? Is this Kimberly McTerrion?
Yes.
Dr. McTerrion, okay. Nina, this is the Dr. Kimberly McTerrion I was talking about, with the founder of Save Our Sons, and she's going to be on with us. But I wanted to ask, and Kimberly, can you please introduce yourself to the audience as well?
Well, sure. The listening audience and thinking about it. My name is Dr. Kimberly Terrian. I am the president of Save Our Sons. And I'm also the CEO of SOS Consulting Firm, which deals heavily with legislation and holding agencies accountable through their laws and practices.
Thank you so much, Doctor. I want to, I was talking with Nina about you, and I don't know if you heard when Nina was talking, but she was actually an attorney herself. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Nina, since you've been in American prisons and also in London, in the UK, can you tell me, first of all, I'd like to ask, what is the average sentencing guidelines that they have in the prisons in London or in the UK? Because my understanding is the maximum is 25 years unless it involves terrorism, serial killing, or mass murders. And it seems to be not a 25-year max seems to be the norm for many countries across the pond, and also with Norway being the role model prison system around the world. So I'd like to have your thoughts on that, and also what you have experienced in your travels, in your involvement. And I have heard of Project Rebound, but what you have experienced or seen regarding the abuses and the deprivations that go on in the penal system.
Yeah, big question. So your first one, sentencing. I mean, unfortunately, in the UK, our sentence lengths have been increasing over the last 20 years. And that's causing a huge problem within our prisons in terms of overcrowding, in terms of the rates of incarceration. So in the last couple of weeks, the government released some new projection figures for our prisons. That's due to rise around 30% over the next 4 years. And it's actually already increased, you know, which would then be an increase of about 47% over 7 years. So, you know, we really are, you know, we have the highest rates of incarceration in Western Europe. And, you know, about 70 out of our, I think, 121 or so prisons are overcrowded. And so actually our government is having to put in place some emergency measures at the moment. So they're looking at, you know, whether they, you know, rent prison cells from the Netherlands, actually, for, you know, who are closing their prisons. You know, they're looking at measures, some more positive measures about starting to reduce the number of people on short sentences in our prisons. But they're doing that, you know, without necessarily having sufficient community support for people as well, because it's being done as sort of a sort of an urgent measure rather than a planned measure. So there's lots sort of happening here, and I think in terms of the very long sentences, you know, like you in the US, we're also heading towards, you know, we're in an election year as well, and, you know, ever-increasing sentences and more punitive sentences is certainly that sort of tough on crime language we start to see sort of ramping up, you know, around this time, as I'm sure many countries do as well. So, you know, there's actually a consultation at the moment about sentencing for cases of murder, and there's a potential push to try to move the minimum term that people serve, make people serve a longer minimum term before they can be eligible for parole. And what we do know from the research, particularly when it comes to young adults that have been sentenced to long sentences, that having those very long periods of time before you're eligible to go up for parole to show that you're no longer a risk means of just that lack of hope and the lack of motivation to engage, and that makes life more difficult, you know, for the people running the prisons, for the people in the prisons, when you know, people don't feel that a sense of hope. And I think actually, you asked me about the conditions in prisons at the moment in the UK. Unfortunately, you know, I think like many countries, you know, we're still really in a position that's very similar to the pandemic, where many people are having to spend around 23 hours a day still locked up in their cells. Yeah. The difficulty we're having here in the UK is that we, prior to the pandemic, there was a sustained period of time where we had cuts to staffing within our prisons. The number of prison staff was reduced. And so now we've got this, you know, really expanded prison population, but we don't have the numbers of staff able to be there to let people out of their cells, to get them to classrooms, to get them to programs, to get them to, you know, the positive things that they should be doing and have access to. So access to lawyers, access to assessment services, their probation officers. And that's, you know, having a massive impact on the mental health of people. We've seen record levels of self-harm in our prisons as well. So, you know, we've really got a real, you know, sort of toxic mix at the moment within our prisons of overcrowding, of lack of staff. They are trying to recruit lots of staff into the UK, but what we know is that a large number of people aren't staying in the roles. They're leaving the roles, you know, even under a year they stay and they leave. So we've got very inexperienced staff in our prisons as well, without sufficient training in relational work, you know, how to build those relationships. And not the time, you know, not the time, because their caseloads are so big and there's, you know, very small amount of staff. So we've really got, you know, a dangerous situation. And we have something called His Majesty's Inspector of Prisons here. So we have inspectors that go into the prisons and do regular inspections. And they have something called an urgent notification, where when things are so bad, they can highlight it as being, you know, something urgent to put, you know, to put resources into. And more often now, the inspection are using this mechanism of urgent notifications to raise the red flag about just how dire the situations are, you know, in our prisons.
You mentioned mental health issues, and this is something that I've been talking a lot about on the show, is the mental health issues that we have in the United States of America, not only in the communities, but mainly and especially in the penal system. We have 2.3 million people incarcerated, men, women, and youth in the United States prisons, and many of them have been children that were traumatized and becoming adults. And they have been resilient for many years, but something can happen to set them off. And a lot of these people incarcerated were traumatized as children or adolescents, you know, and they were never the problems were never addressed. Now they're in the prisons, and we do not have a penal system in the United States of America that has the trained providers that they should have. And they are contracting out with medical providers that are either inexperienced, they're cheap. So they go with the cheapest of the contracted providers. And we have, like, WellPath in the United States has has over 1,000 lawsuits filed against them, and so many people have died under the hands of WellPath and also permanently damaged. There are other providers like that. So we have, and mental health is a major issue in the United States, and also addictions. These things need to be addressed not in a prison, but in a long-term residential treatment facility for mentally ill or for the addicted. And I want Dr. Kimberly Mokhtarian, and you also, Dr. Champion, I would like to have you both talk about some of the issues that you see that are in need of addressing and how our government can go about addressing these issues. Because, as you said, a lot of these people are being sentenced to long term, and a lot of them have been in already 25, 30 years. A lot of them went in under the age of 25. So one of the things, since I have been inviting people from the UK, from Amsterdam, you know, the Netherlands, and across the pond to speak on the show, things are happening in the United States. And I don't know if it's because they're seeing the progress, the things that are happening in your countries that are helping people or that are allowing people hope for someday being out again in the communities. They don't have that here. They have first-time offenders serving life and life without parole on death row. They have wrongfully convicted across the board. They have victims who became offenders. These are all people that are serving life and life without parole sentencing. And these things have to be addressed. It has to stop because we have the highest rates of incarceration, even above China, which is very unusual. So yeah. I'd like to have you and Kimberly Mokhtarian also speak on these issues, if you will, both of you. So I'm going to put myself on mute and have you discuss some of these things. It's very important, especially to an audience that may not be aware of these things. A lot of times prison is a stereotype. You know, it's either black or white, or it's all suits, you know, all people incarcerated fall under the name of criminal. And it's not true, because there are some of the best people behind those prison walls. So if you girls can please expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to pick up on just that very last thing that you said, really, in terms of potential and, you know, and people. And I think that's what I saw in my work, particularly when I worked in prison education, that there were many people who you know, hadn't succeeded in school because of things that were going on in their life at the time, and trauma or learning, you know, undiagnosed learning disabilities or difficulties, who ended up in prison and who really thought that learning or education wasn't for them, but then actually you know, really discovered that, you know, they had a passion or a skill or some expertise, and those sort of programs being really, really important. And the potential for people to become leaders in their community and and to change policy and to, you know, have a real influence if that sort of leadership training was made available. And so when I came back from the US, I set up a project called Elevate, which was at the Criminal Justice Alliance, and we've just had the end of the first cohort of people who had a range of lived experiences of the criminal justice system. Some had family members in prison, some had been in prison, some had had convictions, and some had been victims of crime. And, you know, it was just incredible watching them grow as leaders and to see what they're doing now in trying to change the system, you know, for the better in their different roles within the criminal justice system. So there definitely is, you know, a huge number of people that really, you know, have that potential, have that opportunity to go and experience that. But if we're not dealing with the trauma, like you talked about, then we're actually causing more trauma through the experiences of being in prison, where they don't have access to those sort of purposeful activities, to the education, to the support that they need, to their family networks. You know, then that just isn't going to happen. You know, in reality, that potential isn't going to be unlocked because of their some mental health problems that will be caused by it.
And you know, real quickly, I was going to say too, right now there's several states that have actually considered what you mentioned about family communication and everything. And now some states are making it possible for the incarcerated individuals to call home, and it's not at no cost to them or their family members. They've also made it possible through Corelinks and Securus to be able to email one another at no cost. And now they have the tablets where they can actually call right from their cells. And these are improvements that are happening in several of the states in the United States, and I'm hoping that it will expand because it has started to bring families together. Now they're able to have that communication and feel more hope. So I just want to bring
family
that
connection
up.
Is exactly. Super important. Interestingly, on technology, 10 years ago I wrote a report called Through the Gateway, which was around the use of technology for education, resettlement and family contact. And there have been some improvements in the UK, but there's really, you know, could be a lot more, as you said, in order, you know, to keep people in communication. I remember being in a prison in Denmark where they had access to mobile phones. So a dad in the prison there could text, you know, his son, or his son could text him, because, you know, in order to enable that sort of communication with their teenage sons. Yeah, there's a lot more focus on families, and we have some really good projects here in the UK. We've got Park Prison in Wales, in particular. There's an organisation called Prison Advice and Care Trust who have a project called Roots for Change, which supports families and actually gives support to families as well as the people inside and together all the way through, you know, the sentence and leading up to release and after release, with mentors and peer support. So there are some really fantastic projects, but what tends to happen here, sort of in the UK in particular, is that we have sort of pilots, or we have sort of pockets of good practice where that sort of innovation is, but it's not scaled up across the system more broadly, and that's where we're sort of getting stuck, really.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that. And Dr. McTerrion.
Yes.
Could you talk about some of the things that you have been seeing in the penal system or with the incarcerated, and some of the things that Save Our Sons actually, you know, does for the incarcerated sons of family members?
Absolutely. Well, let me just say this. I think the terminology that you've used is the penal system, and as a professional in the penal system, as we would call it in America, I'm also an educator, and I'm very concerned about how we look or observe what it is that America has presented. And I don't really care to say that the business of the criminal justice system is to rehabilitate people, and that is why you see the long glimpse of sentencing that is bestowed upon those who are incarcerated, because it was only used to penalize and capitalize and profit. It was never designed to correct or enhance or redirect. And so when we come to that realization, I believe that we can actually begin to dismantle the perception of what the institutions are designed to do versus what they say they'll do. And that is what my concern is because it shouldn't take this long to unravel half of our men out of the institutions of slavery, another form of slavery. I'm working on a project now through Save Our Sons that addresses the intent of the penal system. As early as 1870, our first state prison in North Carolina was built in 1870, 5 years after the emancipation took place, and it was built on an old plantation. The former slaves were the ones who built the cells and put themselves in the prison. We have documentation of that. So if we're looking for America to address criminality, what we really should be looking at is how to address America's crooks, because they've licensed themselves to profit off of pain in the penitentiary. And basically, they've created the pain, they've created the mental health issues in our society that drive some of our young men to commit these crimes, and then they excessively punish, tax, and break them, so that now your pharmaceutical industry, in Raleigh, North Carolina, we are home to the RTP, which is the Research Triangle Park, and they try all the medications on our mentally ill. Not only them, but those, their children who are in foster care. So not only are the lowest of our society being guinea pigs for the pharmaceutical companies, they're also being guinea pigs in the institution. So it all goes hand in hand. Capitalism is creating an entire cycle or engineering the demise of its own people. So we have to really ask ourselves, are we in a country or are we in a corporation that basically profits or breaks its people to make profits?
I'm glad you said that, because Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands, has brought that up so many times on the radio show, the prisons for profit. You know, these large corporations that are making so much money off the incarcerated, and they sell things for $300, sneakers for $300, $400 a pair, when the incarcerated individuals get 97 to a dollar, you know, 97 cents to a dollar to make these things. That's a major issue as well.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's proselytizing. It's definitely, you know, whether we want to believe it or not, but we almost look like the Holocaust without the gas. And the only gas that we're actually inhaling is the lies of a country who says it believes and loves its own people. But what we're seeing is they're breaking society down to quote-unquote, fix it again. And that in itself is the definition of racketeering. When you break something deliberately so that you can fix it, that's racketeering. And they pay numerous amounts. And we see it on this side, but if we even looked at the equal budget of the Department of Defense, the Department of Defense is the same way. They go inside certain countries, they cause disruption and chaos, and then they pay themselves to go fix it. And this is what we're seeing in our own country. We're seeing this across the board, and it is a pattern of practice. And until we start engaging on how to hold America accountable for its own corruption, we'll continue to see the exploitation of prisoners.
Thank you for that. You know, we have in this country, Nina, you have probably heard about these incidences, but there's been mass shootings around the country, and it's becoming a regular.
Yes.
And the number of people that are doing the mass shootings are pretty much young people, adolescents. And even in Massachusetts, Brockton, Massachusetts, the governor was considering bringing in the National Guard for one of the prisons, because there's been so much violence that even the teachers trying to break it up are getting hurt. And this is a major issue. So again, there's so much going on in this country, and these children, I call them children, these adolescents or youth, they have no role models to look up to anymore. There's no role models, and everyone wants these youth, they want them to be adults one minute, and they want them to be children on another. And the children are seeing all this division in this country. They're seeing all this chaos going on, and if the adults can't manage it, how can we expect these young people to manage it? So we have mass incarceration, and it's all because of mental illnesses, of addictions, of children that are growing up with no father, growing up in ghetto areas where there's a drug-infested environment. They're growing up in domestic violent homes. They're growing up, you know, not opening up about maybe some violations that occurred in their life as children or abuses they experienced. And then to go into a prison where there's more abuse by actually the overseers, and there's no oversight of the overseers. So these are all major issues that go on in these prison systems. I'm so thankful, Nina, that you are knowledgeable of what's going on in the United States as well as in London, because the ones that have been coming on from abroad have been, most of them have been familiar with the penal system or the prison system in the United States. And a lot of them have been in, like Franz, he's been in Massachusetts prisons, he's been in New York prisons, he's out there working in Texas. And on March 13th at 2 o'clock our time, Eastern time, Franz Dow will be coming on with Gary Cohen, who is a criminal defense attorney out of Texas. So these are things that they're working on, and I'm thankful that everyone from abroad knows as well what's going on in the United States prisons, because changes are being made, and I believe they're listening to a lot of you that are coming on from abroad. I think they're taking in some of the advice that you have. They're taking in some of your insight, a lot of your insight, and changes are being made. So Nina, you mentioned that you do consulting in London, and your consulting, is it on the criminal justice areas, or is it a variety of other discussions or consulting?
So the consulting that I do is on a whole range of things. So it can be all around sort of criminal justice, those policy work. I'm doing some work at the moment for a philanthropist who's looking to invest in programs in the UK, so supporting funders to think about where, you know, their philanthropic funding is best placed to be spent. But I'm also in the process of setting up a social enterprise, which is looking at bringing systems thinking and systems approaches to the criminal justice space in the UK, because I've been doing a lot of, as I mentioned, I kind of have worked across the whole sort of ecosystem around criminal justice, and it was interesting what you were just saying about the penal system, and obviously we've got our health systems, we've got our education systems. You know, crime and what we do about crime is a really complex issue, because there's sort of multiple sort of actors, there's lots of changing, you know, sort of variables. And what we tend to do, you know, and I've done this as well through my career, is focus on a small part of the system to try and change that one part of the system without necessarily looking at the, you know, the bigger picture, the more complex picture. And it can feel quite overwhelming when we're sort of looking at that whole picture, because as you've been talking about, mental health, about education, about poverty, around, you know, racism, you know, violence in the home, all these sort of complex and interplaying factors. But what I've discovered over the last sort of year or couple of years, I've been doing a lot of training in something called systems thinking and systems mapping, and these sort of approaches that can really help us to look at the system and visualize it, because it's quite hard to visualize what's going on. And it can also be hard to think, well, okay, we've got these events that are all sort of happening above the surface. We've got, as you've talked about, we've got violence in our prisons, or we've got, you know, overcrowding, or we've got young people who are, you know, kind of transitioning through into, you know, that school to prison pipeline. You know, what's going on under the surface? Why is this happening? What are the root causes? What are some of the mindsets that are caused, you know, that our politicians have got, that the public have got, that we need to start to address if we really want to get some, you know, bigger, you know, sort of more radical changes in how we think about the system. And I really loved what, you know, you said before about this, you know, what the system is designed to do and what it's supposed to do. And actually, you know, how do we start redesigning and reimagining what the system should look like and be doing to cause less harm, to enable people to thrive, to enable people to be safe in their neighbourhoods? You know, what does that look like, and how can we bring everyone together on that journey? And so I've been doing a lot of training here in the UK with something called the School of System Change, using a lot of methodologies. And these are, in really interestingly, being used a lot in the environmental sector, in climate justice, to think about how do we start to get big change in the ways in which we can help to reduce climate change. And so I'm really excited about using some of these approaches within the criminal justice space, because it provides a new way of us, you know, seeing the problem differently, thinking about it differently, and then doing differently so that we can achieve broader, you know, bigger change. And so much of it is about collaboration, not working in our silos, not working individually, but how do we really collaborate effectively I've always worked across.
I'm glad you're asking, because I'll tell you right now, you and Kimberly both have touched on something that I wanted to ask both of you what your thoughts are. I'm wondering why we cannot have our government leaders around the criminal justice arena meet, network with people around the world, and at least once a year or once every couple of years, to have all of these people come together in a conference and discuss exactly what you two women are talking about and try to understand how all of these countries are operating, their successes, their failures, you know, how they can help one another. I think to be more consistent across the board, and I mean the whole entire globe, is to have representatives from every country come together once or twice, once a year or once every couple of years to come around the table and talk about what countries are more successful, what are they doing right, what are we doing wrong in this country. And this, I want your thoughts on this, because this is something that has been a passion of mine, to see our countries come together to address these on a global issue and come up with solutions, because some countries seem to be so much more successful than others. And our country right now is the biggest failure, because it has the biggest mass incarceration. And so what are your thoughts, both of you, on these issues of coming together globally once a year or once every couple of years to go over all these and provide updates and share information? I believe that would be a success story globally.
Absolutely. I completely agree, Leona. And I've always thought, you know, we sort of have these sort of annual big conferences for climate change, like the COP28, you know, and others that we sort of have, these sort of big global, you know, whether you get this, you know, senior political leaders, you know, big corporations, you know, sort of everybody in the room, you know, really kind of trying to learn from each other, to sign up to global agreements. And, you know, there are some ways in which that happens in criminal justice, but not at that senior sort of political level. And that's absolutely what I would really love to see. Obviously, we've got, you know, sort of the United Nations, and there's, you know, academic global conferences that happen. I used to be part of the European Prison Education Association, so I used to organise conferences across that, and often with guests from Australia or from the US as well as across Europe. And I think you're absolutely right. We need to see this is a global problem, and we need to be working much more globally, you know, learning from, you know, good practice in other countries, you know, doing what I did, you know, on my travels, and actually sort of going and visiting, going and understanding what the differences are, and then where there is good practice, taking it back to countries and implementing that, but really kind of getting people together, as you suggest, you know, I think is the way forward.
And your thoughts, Kimberly?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Excuse me, I usually mute my phone so you don't hear the rumble in the bag.
I appreciate it.
But I do agree. Yes. I do agree. I think there should be a sense of accumulation of data that is derived from various aspects of criminal justice, whether nationally or abroad. And I do believe there should be, just like the GN Summit or any other international platforms, that the UN comes together, or as you all can see, they're now talking about reparations, then why can't we have those same discussions about human rights and preserving dignity and respect to prisoners and corruption and the criminal justice department across the board, so that we can, you know, have a fair and a just system for humanity, no matter where you are in the world.
Thank you for that. You know, there's funding, philanthropists, there's funding for, if our own government cannot do these things, perhaps consultants like yourselves in with experience in the criminal justice arena. And I'm a person, I network with advocates around the country, and Dr. McTerrion knows this. I network with people around the country and possibly around the world whenever possible, because I feel a network, the only way for problems to be resolved. And I'm thinking if our government is not going to do this, then maybe having consultants, you know, maybe having organizations around the country and around the world come together and meet on a yearly or bi-monthly basis to discuss these things and bring it back to the legislative members. But I think the government will and can get involved if we were to put to challenge them, to put pressure on them to do this. I know that Franz Dahl does work with the United Nations, and I know that the Department of Justice in the United States has recently announced that they now see that there is a real problem with mass incarceration in the United States. They know there's a real problem, and so now the Department of Justice is looking at, I think it's six different ways that they're going to start working on reducing some of this mass incarceration. But this is a good time to network, to join forces with one another in solidarity, you know, to get others involved and perhaps start talking about a global conference once a year or once every couple of years. And, you know, I would do the research, even for the funding, I would do the research and let you, all of you know, you know, these resources, where they are and how you can apply for them to get some things like this going. I think it would be a success, and I don't think you'd have a problem getting the funding.
I just wanted to mention two organizations that work internationally that's worth sort of mentioning. One is Penal Reform International, who do a lot of fantastic work globally, and the other is the Incarceration Nations Network, which when I was at Criminal Justice Alliance, we were part of that network, and that's a fantastic network of organizations across the world as well. So, you know, there are definitely organizations that are starting to work on a more global scale. And I know with the Incarceration Nations Network, they also set up a global Freedom Fellowship, which is a lived experience leadership program. People who've been incarcerated who can then go on a global leadership program. So, you know, similar to what Just Leadership were doing in, you know, in the US and what Elevate was doing in the UK, but drawing more globally as well to enable people to, you know, leaders who've, you know, been part of the system, who want to then impact the system, how they can come together globally as well. And I know that when we introduced members of the Elevate program to people internationally, you know, and they had opportunities as well to, you know, to make those international connections, how fruitful those connections are, where we can, you know, build those relationships. You know, and we've got the technology now to do it. We've got, you know, the technology to be able to connect people up together, so we should be using that better. And this is where I think a lot of the systems thinking methodologies really come into their own, is because it provides a way of having discussions, a way of visualizing our different systems and talking about those systems and facilitating those sorts of conversations, so that it's not just talking about the problem, but it's also kind of really deeply understanding what's causing the problem and also thinking about solutions as well, and what does, you know, what are the dominant systems that are currently in place, but what are the emerging things? What are the real positives, the green shoots, you know, like you were talking about, you know, with, you know, technology and family contact, for example, you know, where are the positive things that are happening that we should be knowing about, and how do we make sure that we nourish that system to make sure that they thrive, and this new emerging system that sort of comes through, and we do that globally.
You know, this is what we really, really need, some things like this. And I think it's just awesome talking about it, because it's, you know, another thing we have in the United States is we have a high rate of suicides in the prisons. And this clearly indicates there are mental health issues, but there's also other issues going on. So we also need to see that oversight in the prison system. We need to see oversight over the overseers. But Franz Dahl and Gary Cohen, they're going to be on March 13th, and I would love to have you girls come on then too, and anyone else, because this is an opportunity to come together to start addressing these on a more regular basis. and even Donna Wynette, the founder of Families and Friends for the Mentally Ill, she's been trying to get the Department of Mental Health involved and a lot of these hospitals involved in going into these prisons independently to actually work with these incarcerated individuals that are so desperately in need of either mental health or medical. So these are some things that I really, really hope you girls can think about and perhaps come back and talk about that as well. But there's too much sadness. There's too much sadness because a lot of these people behind those bars, as I say, they're victims. They've been victims all their lives. And they might have done something wrong. A lot of them are wrongfully convicted. But for those who have done something wrong, for first offense or whatever, they need to be able to have that second chance. And they need to be able to have that help that they need. There was one prisoner who was evaluated, which I believe he is desperately a victim of PTSD. And I know there's so many others behind the prison walls that have that. But they're diagnosing them with antisocial behaviors because this puts more fear into the public, which means that high rates of incarceration are coming as a result of the fear that people have. So there's a lot of people that are being diagnosed with antisocial behavior, which I think is wrong. They should not be diagnosed with antisocial behavior, and they should be evaluated by appropriate psychologists. And I'm sure that many of you heard that young man that went over the judge's bench to try to attack her. There was a judge previous to that one that ordered this young man to be evaluated to see if he was competent to go before the judge. And I consider the incompetent psychologist that said he was competent enough to go before the judge was the fault of that young man. He leaped over to attack the judge. He got severely beaten up because of it, and he had 4 years more added on to his case. When he was already out, the judge added more 4 years more. Had he been diagnosed with the incompetence, then he would not have gone before the judge. They would have been able to help him, treat him, and then bring him before a judge at a later time. But these are some of the things that go on in the U.S. prisons. And it's sad because no one is seeing this. No one is addressing these issues. And it's only getting worse.
I think that's a really good point about, you know, this concept that we can't see what's going on. I think that's one of the real difficulties is about how we bridge the gap really between the public's understanding and what sort of happens behind those sort of walls. We have inspectors that go into our prisons in the UK and we do get sort of media coverage of their reports and the conditions, but I think it's difficult for people to understand what that really means and looks like. So I think there's I know you had Veronique on before from Rescales who talking about small scale detention. And I think one of the benefits of these small scale projects where they really are thinking about community integration and how do we get the public to understand, and care about these issues. And I think that's something that we've really got to sort of grapple with and to make that happen. And some positive things that are happening here in the UK. There's more local-based, deep democracy processes sort of happening. And I know that, I came across some in the US as well, where, actually issues around community safety, around, what should the solutions be, are being discussed at a very local level with communities and even some budgets, local budgets being given to communities to decide, how to spend those budgets to make their communities safer. And I think we need to see a lot more of that to really engage with the public about criminal justice and crime and what the solutions are and to empower local people as well to understand more and to have more say about how their taxpayers' money is being spent in terms of trying to reduce crime and addressing issues so that they feel safe in their neighbourhoods. So I think, you know, we need to do a lot more in that space of really working with the public in very different ways than we have done in the past.
I think what you mentioned about funding these organizations to do these things, a lot of organizations have been funded to do these things, and they have it on their website to help, but they don't. ACLU is a perfect example. They have turned away so many people who have been desperately asking for help, seeking help. I remember in 2007-08, and I say this all the time, I went out to Pennsylvania, my organization representatives. We went out to Pennsylvania because there were three people being detained in a hole. They were being severely abused, and they were crying out for help. And I contacted some of the caucus legislative members, a couple of them, and I contacted ACLU, and they completely ignored it every time. Before and after each one of these individuals died, and they alleged it was suicide, one of those individuals was due to come out like 5 months from before he was alleged to have committed suicide. And ACLU, it's the same excuse all the time. They don't have the funds, or they don't have the staff. If they don't have it, they shouldn't have anything on their website. Because there have been prisoners all the way back to 2000, and we are 24 years later, still getting the same answers from ACLU. They will help when it comes to immigration, because there's so much money being given for this in this area. But long before these immigration issues started, they weren't there to address these issues of suicide, alleged suicide. They weren't there to help these prisoners crying out. And this is sad, because this goes on all too often. One advocate, she was a lawyer, and her firm was getting money, and she said her husband was in prison, but he was out. How did he get out? Was the money used for her husband? And then, if it was, is she advocating, are they using the funds to help their friends and their friends' family, and they're picking and choosing? This is a major problem, too, in this country. And I don't know if it goes on in other countries, but it's something that needs to be looked at. These organizations need to have oversight as well as those in the Department of Corrections around the country. There needs to be oversight. And this isn't happening. Kimberly, your thoughts?
Well, I believe that's why we set ourselves up as Save Our Sons. We have basically added the word agency to our organization, where we assist with bringing that transparency to institutions and departments across the nation, especially when it comes to law enforcement, and that would cover correctional officers, doctors that are inside the prisons or the detention centers, and even looking at legislators, because at the federal level, we have quite a few guys who are in prison for life for under the crack cocaine sentencing law. And this was brought about very early on, even during Biden and Bill Clinton's tenure as president. But what we've seen is when you don't cooperate with the government or provide them any information that they feel like you have, then they sentence you to life. And so that in itself is like an abuse of authority. It certainly does not have any real oversight, and it doesn't speak to the crime that you committed. You know, at first they were going to give you 12 years if you told on somebody, and when you didn't, they gave you life. So are you committing a crime? Are you serving time for the crime you committed, or are you serving time because it's a federal flogging? So we're seeing, like, abuse of authority throughout our institutions. And we're seeing abuse of authority from the judgeship all the way down to the correctional officer inside the prisons, who basically don't hear our young people tell you that they're suicidal. They don't check on them regularly like they're supposed to every 15 minutes, I believe, in certain institutions. And so they're just leaving our young people, they're leaving our men to die. And that in itself is a violation of human rights. And that's why I'm a big stickler, I love going back to where Malcolm X left off. It's holding the United States accountable across the board. We can talk about reform and try to do reform from a collective effort, but there has to be a major oversight over, I believe, over the United States so that we don't depend upon them solely to do the right thing. Because remember, and I know you know, Leona, that, heck, certain populations were not even included, I mean, until George Floyd died. So once George Floyd died, we received DEI, even though we've been on this land for over 400 years. Certain groups were not even considered to be humanly recognized or included until one person died. Now they're taking that back off the table. So we need more stability. We need more transparency. We need laws and oversight that will hold institutions accountable. And we actually need policies that work, and they don't change based off of someone's election or funding or volunteer service. We need something that is concrete for every human across this nation.
Exactly. I want to say, as far as the leadership, and we're going to talk about the people of color, because our leaders, our black leaders, are a failure as well. And the reason I say this is because I don't know if you've noticed or others have noticed, but if you go on inmate locator or prisoner locator, you're going to find a lot of people of color that are in the prisons today. Their race is listed unknown. So how does a Census Bureau keep statistics when there's no races under these people of color around the country? And had the black leaders done their job and followed all of this, they would see themselves, the inequality, when these people are not being listed, their races are not being listed. And that's a disappointment, because Martin Luther King, as you mentioned, he fought for freedom. He made it possible for these leaders today to be able to do something to help the people, especially those in the prisons. And yet they deserted them. They went AWOL. So I have a thing with them as well. And this is something that needs to be looked at, is these people around the country that are incarcerated, and they're listed as the race unknown. That's a serious problem. That's where statistics are really messed up.
I agree. Leon, if I could speak to or piggyback certainly on the absentee so-called spiritual fathers of our community who have nothing to say about the situations that go on from the front doors of our homes to broken homes all the way to the prison system. They have just been absolutely disconnected. And the reality is, I don't believe a lot of the things would be going on in our community or inside these institutions if our leaders were much more involved, engaged, and proactive on some, if not all, of the issues that plague our community. Because you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be present. And when you're not present, then it gives the system, you almost give it an allowance to be corrupt.
Exactly.
And I believe that once when you have staged your entire enterprise or your personal kingdoms to go behind the four walls and never come out, that is the difference between Dr. Martin Luther King and what we see today, is that he brought the fight and the argument beyond the church walls. He spilled them out into the street, and he took them all the way to Congress. And so we have people who are Sunday morning marchers. They march into the church and they march out back home. And that is as far as they go, back to the church and back home. And so they are disconnected from, everyday life. And if they're not having some personal gain from fellowshipping with those in the political arena, like you saw, many of you all may have saw with Trump, his whole lineup was to engage the evangelicals so that he could buy them or buy their notoriety or whatever. But again, it's only a show. It's only a horse and pony show. It has nothing to do with holding him accountable or anybody else, because, of course, if he was held accountable, they would stop them and say, excuse me, how many sexual acts or how many indictments do we have to live through? Obviously, they're totally disconnected from sin, and they don't care what, you know, who commits them, because they just want to be nationalists. And honestly, I believe a lot of black pastors have joined the ranks of ignoring the real issues, so they're deliberately leaving us behind. And that is something I agree with you that needs to be challenged and exposed.
Exactly. We have too many opportunists in this country. They want to be before the media, and they don't even talk about the seriousness of mass incarceration in the United States. I actually tried to connect with, through National Action Network, with Al Sharpton, who has Politics Nation on CNN, to see if he would use his platform to address the penal system, to address the issues going on in the prisons, the abuses, the violations, you know, the mass incarceration, the mental illnesses, the addictions. And again, it's like reaching out to people that are just opportunists. They want to be in front of the media, but they don't want to be doing the work to be transparent as to what they're doing. That's what I believe. And Nina, I'm hoping that you and Veronique, and Nina mentioned Veronique. She has the Rescale, which is houses that house people that are in prison, that are the small, you can explain this too, Nina, because I might get this wrong, but they take in less serious, and then they have bigger houses for the more serious people that are, would normally be in the prisons instead of being in these houses that they have established. And maybe that's what we need in this country as well. Nina, can you speak a little bit about that? Unfortunately, Veronique couldn't make it today.
Yeah, I mean, the Rescale movement is a movement that is joining up countries that are looking to move away from the traditional sort of prison, you know, big scale, you know, panopticon designed prison that we see replicated all around the world. And, you know, it's a big issue here in the UK because, you know, we're building bigger and bigger prisons, you know, from, you know, 1,500 up to, you know, to 3,000 prisoners. And we know that the smaller the scale, the more personalized that it can be, the more, you know, the more access there can be to the local community, to, you know, the more personalized that the regime can be. And so what Rescaled is doing is highlighting and kind of building a network of countries and organizations that are doing something different, that are having people that are serving a sentence, but serving a sentence in a much smaller scale detention facility. So like a house, like a you know, a much smaller scale. And these look different all around the world. I was at a conference recently in the Czech Republic where they had people come from Brazil, where there was about 40 or so different sort of models in Brazil, and from the Netherlands, from the Czech Republic, from other countries who are looking at sort of smaller scale custodial facilities. And actually recently I was visiting a small scale facility here in the UK that was set up actually by a philanthropist who funded it for women in particular, and this is a particular interest of mine, having worked for the charity Women in Prison and supported women after release. And this is called Hope Street, and it's a small residential custodial facility being used instead of sending a woman to one of our women's prisons. They're sent to complete their sentence at a women's residential centre. So it's designed specifically with, you talked earlier about sort of trauma, you know, it's trauma-informed design, not just in the design of the building, but also in the staff that works there, access to family, access to, you know, therapeutic support. You know, every little thing has been thought about to make it trauma sensitive. You know, and the individual needs of the women can be much better met. So, there's the reskilled movement that Veronique leads on is about connecting all these up, and it's not about having a one-size-fits-all approach, but it's about learning, you know, what are they learning from these new smaller scale programs, how can we build on that learning, how can we start to see what's emerging and actually start to make this the dominant sort of paradigm, the dominant way of thinking about this, rather than the sort of large scale sort of mass incarceration, big prisons, you know, that we know cause more harm and that don't work. So it's something that I'm really interested in seeing, and really excited that this is sort of developing this network. And it's exactly like you said, Leona, it's, you know, what Veronique's doing as well is about that global connection, you know, joining people up that are doing this in different parts of the world so that we can learn from that and to start to kind of look at some of the issues around it and how it could be spread out more broadly. So yeah, I just wanted to come back as well on your point about race as well, because in the UK we actually have higher levels of racial disparity in our prison systems than the US, which, you know, is often a shock to people to hear that. But you know, it's a massive problem, particularly with our younger people in custody as well. So we had a big report here several years ago by a politician called David Lammy, and it was a review called the Lammy Review, and made some excellent recommendations. And there has been some progress, but not sufficient progress, and you know, since George Floyd, since you know, those sorts of issues, we have had more of a focus here in the UK on some of these issues around racial inequality within our criminal justice system, but we've got a long way to go.
We have a long way to go, but the thing is, we have to focus on the way to go. We have to focus on now and in the future. We have to stop thinking so much about the past. And I think this is what keeps everything, you know, stalemate, is when we continue to focus on the past instead of going forward, moving forward. As Kimberly mentioned earlier, you know, Martin Luther King, he did a lot to make things more equal. And now thinking about or talking about the past all the time is not going forward, as I believe Martin Luther King wanted to see happen. But as far as the penal system, as far as coming together globally, coming together in solidarity to see positive changes occurring in the penal system, in the criminal justice division, we need to start networking. And I am going to, as I said, I'll have Franz and Gary Cohen on the show. I'd like to have you come back as well, Nina, and also maybe Veronique and Mariam Jacobs and others that have been coming on the show from abroad, from across the pond, to be able to come on and start talking about these things. And I'd like to invite more people from this country to join you as well, so we can start looking at maybe some kind of preparations to improve the system around the globe. You know, the United States has major problems. It has the highest rates of incarceration. And so they may get something from all of you. And I'd like to see that happen. Sometimes we live in a proud country with people that are so proud that they don't want to feel as though they have to take advice or that they have to have others looking down upon them, which is not the case, that no one is looking down upon them. We're just trying to get the United States to fall in sync with other countries as well and maybe try to work together with everyone. So I'm going to say 252. Do you want to state your name, please?
Hi, it's me, Dr. McTerry, and my other phone
died,
so please forgive me.
Okay. Yeah, we were just talking about the racism that goes on in this country. But I also want to, as I mentioned to Nina, I'd like to have all of you come back on. And Dr. Mariam Jacobs, a psychosocial therapist, I'd like to have Franz and Gary Cohen are going to be on the 13th. But I'd like to... And I want to say Franz Kurz, he's out of Germany. He's been on the show before, but Franz has been sick. He's old now. But they've been advocating for prisoners in the United States. Franz Kurz from Germany has been advocating for Shane Crum and Donald Glenn, two wrongfully convicted in Ohio. Jan Banning, a professional photographer out of Netherlands, has been advocating for Christine Boyle, wrongfully convicted in Georgia. Franz Dow, he's been working with advocates in Texas. He's been in the U.S. prisons as well as the prisons abroad. We have so many people from overseas that are doing as much for the incarcerated in the United States, and they're doing more than many people that are actually living in the United States. So I give credit and honor to them to have them come on the show to talk. But I'd like to see more. I'd like to see more interaction, more connecting, more networking, if possible. So Nina, I was going to say, anytime you and Veronique and anyone else that's on social media, if you can befriend me, I'd like to invite you to a lot of the groups that I belong to as well, so that you can start networking with them and they can get more familiar with all of you.
That would be fantastic.
And the same with you, Kimberly Dr. McTerrion, I'd like to do the same with you. I believe, I'm not sure if I've started, but I've been sending invitations to join a lot of the groups to different people. And I'm going to keep doing that because I think networking is the most important asset we can have,
yes,
to get people familiar, not only with the different cultures, but the different advocates, but the different people involved in the criminal justice system, whether they're family members, whether they're advocates, whether they're former incarcerated men, women, or youth, or whatever the case may be. But I'd like to see us all start networking.
Absolutely. I would love to see us host perhaps a conference, an international conference on human rights and prisons, and bring all of our data together as to what works, what hasn't worked, and where we'd like to see us go as a human race across the board.
You know, that's exactly, Nina was mentioning, you know, it's so easy now to do that too with remote visit, video conferences and everything else. Nina,
sure.
I would love to see you. I would love to see Dr. McTerrion. I'd love to see Veronique. I'd love to see all of you somehow get together and maybe start a video conference just one time to see,
sure,
how it works. And I will get people to join in too.
Yes, and I could help do maybe the outline so that we can make sure that we are pulling the best of the best materials from our sister partners around the world.
Yeah, and it's one of the things actually with the new social enterprise that I'm working on here in the UK that we're seeking funding for at the moment to set up regular sort of online, global meetings as well. So
yes,
yeah, hopefully we'll secure some funding and be able to start to put these on as well. And because using some of the systems models is a really good way of, bringing people together across the globe to share exactly, what you were saying, Kimberly, sort of, what's been happening, and where do we want to go in the future?
If you girls could do that, I would send, if you girls could set something up, if you could connect and set something up and send,
sure,
it to me, I would send it to our legislative members in Massachusetts and other states. I'd have the groups on social media send it to their legislative members, their politicians. Maybe this would be a perfect start to resolving a lot of this and get more consistency across the world instead of just across the state.
Yes, absolutely. That is correct. Well, I'm going to provide, I'm sure Leona can provide you my information via email. Do you have an email address, Nina?
Yeah, that would be great. I look
forward
to getting with you, Kimberly.
Okay,
Nina, go right ahead.
I will give her all that information. I'll give the information to both of you and to the others as well. And like I said, this is awesome. This is a good start to doing something really, really positive. And I want to ask you girls again, too, to give the audience your information, how they can get in touch with you, if they want to do volunteer work, if they want to connect, if they want to get involved in all of this. If you can give them your information so that they can connect with your organizations or your WhatsApp or whatever the case may be.
Through LinkedIn. Nina Champion on LinkedIn.
Oh, that's right. You're on LinkedIn. And Dr. McTerrion, you're on LinkedIn too, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay, audience, now they're giving you this information. I would like to have all of you take this down, or you can play this back after the show is over and try to connect with these advocates, these individuals, these experts in what they're talking about, because they know, they have the experience, the knowledge, and they are consultants. So please connect with them if you can. Nina Champion is on LinkedIn. She is from London. She is a consultant, years experience in the areas of criminal justice. And we have Dr. Kimberly McTerrion, who is also an expert in what she's been doing, Save Our Sons. She's a consultant as well. And they will give you whatever last minute information. But we're going to get this started. We're going to get this connection going. And I'm going to send these invitations out once everything is set up. I'm going to send these invitations out to our legislative members, and hopefully they will be a part of these conversations, these conferences you'll have.
The global movement starts here.
Global movement.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Thank you so much. And I want to say once again, audience, we have a serious issue of mental illnesses in the United States and addiction. And we have to look at these reasons why there's so much of this going on and why it's not being addressed more appropriately. Department of Mental Health, if you contact them and you say there's someone out in the street that's acting out, they will say there's nothing they can do unless that person does something. And once that person or those people do something and they end up in prison, Department of Mental Health does not want to get involved. This is a serious issue. American Psychological Association, they have all this funding to do research, but we don't need the research anymore because we know what the problem is. We need the psychologists and the psychiatrists to address these issues. So if anyone can, start contacting American Psychological Association. Start contacting the Department of Mental Health and other mental health facilities around the country. Try to get them involved in going into the prisons and doing some independent evaluation. Now, I also wanted to mention, Nina, you mentioned something about the media. And I want to say one of the things we have with the media in the United States is they report one-sided stories. And I was watching on, I think it was social media, they said there's always two sides to every story. Then they said there's always three sides. There's his side, her side, and then there's the truth. Unless mm-hmm. the media getting involved in the prison issues and starts going in and talking with these people, then they're not going to be giving the truth about these individuals. You're going to get one-sided stories, and apparently or obviously it might be the wrong story. So 412, you want to state your name, please?
Hi, this is Christine Vila.
How are you, Christine?
Good. I'm just listening in. Thank you, Leona.
Do you have anything you'd like to add to what you've been listening to?
I actually just popped on, and I was trying to catch the tail end of it, so I'm just listening.
Okay, we're talking about the criminal justice arena. We're talking about the problems in the penal system, and we're talking about the possibility of these two consultants coming together to start some video visits to address globally, to address the prison issues and come up with solutions, come up with the problems and the solutions. So this is what we were talking about. But as I was saying, the mental health issues in the United States has to be addressed, and this is a serious problem. And I want the audience to know, I want the audience to know that they should not, please do never, 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 do not stereotype individuals that are incarcerated. A lot of them have had similar issues, but every situation is different. And every situation has a story to tell. Unless our media starts going into the prisons and meeting with these individuals, instead of reporting just one-sided stories from the outside, they will never get the truth out. The truth will never come out. And I just want to reemphasize on that. So if anybody if you have anything you'd like to add before we close, please do.
I was just going to add, Leanne, that something that I worked on when I was at the Criminal Justice Alliance was around working with journalists in the media. And we ran something called the Media Awards, the Commonwealth Media Awards, because it was about recognizing journalists that were reporting on these issues and were reporting on these issues sensitively and constructively and in a solutions-focused way and in a trauma-informed way. And so over the 5 years I was there, we were able to build a really good movement of journalists here in the UK, whether they were sort of investigative journalists or sort of news reporter journalists who were interested in these issues and who were reporting on them in a way in which would get you know, the public better informed and done in a sensitive way as well. So it was about incentivizing them to do that and to build that network and to build the connections between them as well. So yeah, that was just one thing that we worked on here, which we found really useful in terms of helping to start to change the narrative and to have a better informed public, as was by, you know, having these awards for journalists who were reporting on criminal justice issues and prison issues in a positive way.
That's interesting. You know, WBUR in I don't know if WBUR is just Massachusetts or around the country, but I notice a lot of prisoners, they look up to WBUR because WBUR does print or does announce on their radio shows a lot of times issues involving criminal justice, issues involving the prisons and the things that go on. So that's one of them. In Boston Globe years ago used to, I don't know what Boston Globe is doing now, but a lot of these other reporters, and like you said, Nina, trying to look at the ones that are doing the work, that are meeting, going into getting both sides of the story. That's most important.
And we started working as well with journalism students. So people who were studying journalism at university, we had a pilot project which we set up where they would, as part of their studies, they would go and do some court reporting. And actually working with them right at that really early stage to think about how they reported on these issues, to think about, you know, not using sensationalist or stigmatizing language, to, you know, to have people who had been in prison or had lived experience with the criminal justice system come and speak to them so that they could understand the importance of how they reported on these issues, you know, and why it was so important that they, you know, inform the public and not use that sort of sensationalist language. So, you know, working with journalism students was something else that we started to do as well.
I am so glad you brought that up. And Dr. McTerrion, Kimberly, have you thought about that, recruiting journalists in these political science majors to work with you in your organization?
No, but that's a great idea.
No, that's what I did with my organization. I registered with volunteermatch.com. Volunteermatch.com is for nonprofits that can actually go on there and they can register. They can start posting for student volunteer paralegals, volunteer law students, volunteer spokesperson, even grants and things like that. Volunteermatch.com and also the United Way, they do have nonprofits can post for volunteers, but I also registered with the universities around the country. Most of my volunteers at the time I was doing the national were students that were all over the country that were going to school for law, paralegal. They were going to school for political science. They were going to school for psychology. All of these things, and they're just looking to do the volunteer work for people like yourselves because they get the experience. Some of them want to do their internships by volunteering. Some of them want the experience. And some of them actually have loved ones that were or are incarcerated. So you get a variety of people that want to volunteer. So this is an option. And I'll tell you another thing, when I had the organization really going, I was recruiting even those that were from England, from Macedonia, from South Africa. I was getting them from all over, even Polynesia. I was getting them from all over, and they were doing research because they are so far away, they can't actually be doing hands-on or anything. But they were doing extensive research, and they were sharing the resources that we needed with us. So these are options you can actually look into. I think it would be beneficial. And Nina, I don't know if they have that in London, but it would be something you might want to check out as well.
Yes, I agree.
I will send you, Nina, I will send you Kimberly Materian's information. I will send you Nina's information so you girls can connect and decide how you want to proceed from here. And I thank you both for being on. I feel honored that you came on. And I know that this is going to work. It really will. So thank you so much for coming on. And I think our caller calling in as well. I thank her. So we are now going to end this episode. Thank you all for listening in. And again, you have the information for these women that were on today. Please connect with them. Offer your volunteerism or whatever you can to help out with this global issue of incarcerated individuals. Thank you so much.
Thank you.